Well, hi everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you very, 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 very much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. We are thrilled and delighted and super excited to bring our next guest on the show. Do you love movie soundtracks? Do you wish you wouldn't have been a music producer or a composer? I'm sure we all do. We throw a vinyl on, we dig the grooves, we throw our CDs on the player, and even though there's no grooves, those things cut through our heart and into our soul and make us it perks us up and makes us happy. We are thrilled to do what we do, and we love bringing people on the show who speak the same language, live in the same world. I wish we could all live in the same neighborhood and have fun together. But Anthony Agnello is a master of writing and musical understanding. He's a connoisseur. He's a CD sommelier, if you will. So we are going to talk to him about the work he does and the things he's written and just pick his brain because he's pretty damn cool. Maybe we'll invite him on the staff. Who knows? Anthony, how are things in your world? Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It is a pleasure to be here. And it's so funny. It has been so long since I've joined another podcast where I don't have some sort of like established audience base that I no longer know how to sum up what it is that I do in any kind of concise way. But for the Go See Talk listenership and audience, it is very weird. I will just specify very quickly. Mark and I cross paths through Discogs.com, trading records, and it was as simple as Mark bought one of the records from my collection, and I instantly noticed that his username was based on the PlayStation 1 game Ridge Racer 4. And I was like, that is supremely specific coded language for a human being that you should talk to. For me personally, that's that it speaks directly to my life in the entertainment industry. I've been in the sort of entertainment and gaming world for 20 years. Started as a journalist way, way back in the early days of the dot-com boom, as an editor at a website called Nerve.com, where, and for those that don't remember Nerve.com, it was a early aughts sex magazine. Think of it like the New Yorker, equivalent to Playboy. And if you have Max.com, you can still find the old HBO documentary about us.
Woo!
But
Saved
yes,
my watch
I
list right now.
do. Yeah, it's very 2001. Forgive everybody involved. It was it was a very specific tone. But I primarily ran after a few years a gaming vertical for that site called 61 Frames Per Second. I was also one of our film critics and sort of got the start in journalism by interviewing actors and directors and writing film reviews, and then transitioned fully into the gaming world, where for a very long time, just because of my own personal interests, I focused on writing about game soundtracks and game composers, just because it's a niche that has always meant a lot to me. Sort of bounced around the online publishing world, right at that moment where it was a great idea professionally to spend time working for dot coms, 2008 to 2019. Nothing bad happened to journalism in that time. It was wonderful. It was great. We all survived. And everybody didn't have to worry about social media's encroachment on anything. But name it, and I probably contributed there. Way, way back in the day, Electronic Gaming Monthly, GamePro, Edge Magazine, all of the old print standards before doing stints at Joystick and Gadget, GamesRadar. I briefly ran The Escapist, trying to rehabilitate that in the wake of Gamergate and seizing it sort of back from the alt-right movement in gaming. Didn't work. Happens. And then I did a brief stint as a feature writer for The Ringer, trying to bring gaming into their sphere. And around 2020, I moved away from full-time journalism into the world of creative agencies and content marketing and making stuff up purely by dint of professional need. And at the exact same time, over the last 10 years, in sort of the side gig side of my life, have been doing a lot of work for a lot of different record labels who are publishing video game soundtracks. Did a bunch of work with Ship to Shore Records and most recently Laced Records, which that was not concise at all, but it has been a very, very weird century.
You are the Rocky of the journalism world. You're like, you keep punching, you show up to like fights that pay $5, you knock out Spider Rico with some amazing writing. And unfortunately, a lot like those title those wins, they just get swept away by the sands of time. Like, one of the things that you mentioned to me is you wrote for the AV Club and you did this piece on Ridge Racer 4, which kind of cemented digitally this newfound Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart friendship, which we're sharing right now. But unfortunately, today's headlines are tomorrow's birdcage liners. It just sucks. But you know what? You don't fail until you quit. So props to you for fighting that 12-year battle. Jeez, 2009 to 20, 2007 to 2019. Holy crap.
2004,
Oh,
2004 to
wow.
2019 was the full-time journalism years. And like, every now and again, to extend the Rocky metaphor, I'll pull a Rocky Six. I'll come back for an exhibition match. Contributed a piece for the AV Club when they relaunched this past fall, and it was nice to sort of dust off the gloves, as it were. But yeah, it's funny, man. I respect so much what you do with Go See Talk because at this point in time, the like sort of grand era where you could, find a very prominent publishing platform for coverage of the type of music you cover. Like that, it, like there is no such thing as that like big mainstream outlet. They've all been either devoured by the like old dinosaurs of publishing. Even like Pitchfork is, facing sort of an existential crisis over the past year, because Condé Nast is downsizing their properties, and they're like, oh, well, we can't afford to have a full-time, alternative and indie music site. And so, I don't know if you know this, but like Pitchfork is now just like technically just a section of GQ, which is unfortunate. But and then, on the other end of things, the smaller publishing model on the internet has just been devoured by venture capital. And I like it's so funny. Like I Go See Talk is the kind of site that when I first started out in 2004, like this, it would have been a thing that like ad revenue would have just flocked to, and you could keep it going with display ads. And the nice thing is, you could find an audience that was like, holy shit, they talked to the guy that did the soundtrack for Turbo Kid. I love Turbo Kid. And you could just live on that traffic for 6 months. And now, the realities of sort of publishing on the internet are you either need to have like a rock solid single sort of investment backer, or you just got to like keep pursuing it for the love of the game. And like the thing that I love about Go See Talk is it's exactly the kind of thing I want to read. And as a like you're literally keeping the dream of the internet alive, man.
Well, as I like to say very proudly, it's a nonprofit because everything that goes into it sucks profit. I think in the let's see, it's we're over 15 years. I think I've made $600
Hell yeah.
Yeah, in 15 years. Now, when you talk about that's not profit. That is what I've made before you take away the trips to film festivals, all the gas I spend to go to previews, the time I invite. It's like I'm probably down 20 grand if this was to be equated to, missing work to do something. It's like, oh, I get a chance. I get like a 5-minute interview with Will Ferrell. But to me, that is the pride. That is the joy. And, you talk about like golden age and things like that. Like, I've never modeled myself after AV, ain'titcoolnews.com. But I was like, that kind of stuff, that kind of niche, that kind of passion, that's kind of what we want to show. And I say the royal we, because I've had to sort of cut my non-paid writers free a long time ago to pursue other things. And I'm so glad that Bill and Tim and everybody else has been able to do their own thing. But you know what? It's a glorified hobby. I know it pays nothing, but you know what? If I speak to somebody like James Newton Howard, Michael Giacchino, or even like Kellan Lutz, or what was a good one? John Voight, like it means something to me. And then one day I can, if the internet's still around in 20 years, I could show my daughter, be like, your dad was bad.
Hell yeah, dude. And the other thing is too, is I think one of the most important things I've ever heard in my life about any sort of creative enterprise is the advice apparently Conan O'Brien gives to all people is he's like, you don't want to be the lead guitarist. You don't want to be the front man of the band. You want to be the person who's sitting in the back row playing your triangle, and you just keep playing it. You play it better than anyone ever has. And it's funny, like a glorified hobby is not even the right term. Like it is the work, and the work matters. The work will always matter. And I always say to myself, like you think about great writers 100 years ago, you got like your Robert Heinleins, or your Arthur C. Clarkes, and everybody forgets because now we think of those novels as like institutions. They fucking started as zine writers. Like they didn't write their own stories and then like get published and become successful novelists. They fucking loved science fiction. And so they made science fiction zines, and then it just led to these things over the course of decades. And I don't know, man. It's why just to like bring it back to the subject of soundtracks and the world of music a little bit. At this point, the work that I'm doing for record labels is often paid. But 10 years ago, I had my first kid and still working as a full-time journalist as the primary breadwinner for my family, which was just a daily exercise in existential white knuckle terror. It's like this could all fall apart with no security blanket whatsoever. And yet I was still hustling constantly to do things that were not going to be financially beneficial in any way, shape, or form. It's how I started writing liner notes for record labels. And it was as simple as here, this is funny, actually. So you flash back to around 2015, and in 2015, you have that moment where the great pivot to video, the great con of Facebook. Back then, we're talking like four Facebook cons back, not the metaverse, not virtual reality. It's the pivot to video. All websites need to pivot to video. And it was a profound con, because Facebook was devouring basically all of the traffic that websites used to get by dint of the introduction of the news feed in 2011. So part of what I was doing at the time was being invited in to sort of reimagine the video and streaming strategy for gaming outlets, first at Joystick, then in Gadget, and then later GamesRadar. And sort of one of the pillars that I'd established at the time, which again, I was just 10 years too early. But I had a creator talk show that went by many different names under all of those different outlets. And it was all about like highlighting creators that I just thought were super interesting. And it was like, oh, we're gonna bring on the guy who directed Star Wars: Shadows of the Empire for N64 for its 20th anniversary, who told fucking amazing stories. And it turns out that Dash Rendar has a stupid name because George Lucas insisted on a stupid name and he wouldn't let anybody else come up with anything else. Awesome stuff. It was just such a fun show. We had on Kane Hodder, the guy that played Jason, to talk about the Friday the 13th video game. Just like dumb, weird stuff. And we did it 3 times a week at the peak. And the longer time went on, the more it was fighting just to keep that part of the platform alive while I did all the other stuff for the day job. And saying to the owners of these sites, look, I'll do it on my own time. I will continue to host the show by, literally, we'll do it off hours. You get me from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. doing social media management and writing previews and all the stuff that you need for the proper website. I'll put my baby to bed and then I'll do this show late night. And the transition into the vinyl and record industry was 10 years ago. Nobody really was pressing game soundtracks on vinyl. It was very, very, very rare, if it happened at all, or it was the purview of like a collector's niche from the 80s. It was, tracking down super rare Japanese or Taiwanese imprints of like, Konami soundtracks, which are amazing if you can find them. Konami's best. And then it's like one song from Life Force and one song from Twinbee. But a guy named Aaron Hamill started one of the first labels that was, transitioning from doing really small runs of kind of weird niche records, really great TV and movie soundtracks. Mark, help me out if you remember this. There was like a sort of like USA Up All Night style show back in the day called like Billy Bob's Monster Theater or something
Oh,
like that.
yeah, Billy Bob's Drive-In or something, like drive-in movie on TNT or
Yes.
TBS. Yes, I remember
Yes.
that very well.
Right. And so Ship to Shore Records published a vinyl of all the interstitial music
No
from,
way.
yeah, like awesome stuff, like so cool. And then they were like, hey, we love video games, let's start doing video game music. And their first big signee was they started doing Konami soundtracks. Really super weird stuff. They ended up doing the soundtrack to this bizarre old NES game that never made it outside of Japan called LaGrange Point. Just neat artifacts. And so I had Aaron Hamill on the talk show at the time and said to him, like, Aaron, what you're doing is the coolest thing in the world. If you ever need or want liner notes, I'll write them. And he's like, well, what would you ask for them? I'd be like, a copy of the record? And that's like, again, like it's just finding the work and doing the work. And it was so funny. I had him on the show a couple of times just to talk about what the label was doing. And eventually he was like, oh, do you have any, sort of affection for the Darius series? And if you've never heard of it, that's not a surprise. It has never been big, but it was a series of like side-scrolling shmups, shooters, primarily in the 80s, and then they had a couple of resurgences in the 90s. Really, really cool, weird soundtracks, headed up by the Taito in-house band Zantata, and the composer Hiroshi Oguchi, who would say just wild shit. He's like, "Yes, I was trying to tap into the firmament of the universe with these songs."
Ego
And so I,
much?
oh, dude, like just. Like when you talk to people that made arcade games in the 80s, the ambition, just the ego and the ambition was so nuts. But that was it, you know, a bunch of different soundtracks after that. And I met somebody purely through Twitter at the time, just a guy named Jeremy Lamont, who Jeremy's probably going to end up listening to this. And Jeremy was like, "Hey man, I'm fascinated by game vinyl too. Do you want to start a podcast about game, like video game soundtracks on vinyl? Talk about niche." And we did that. We dude, Mark, you talk about like I $600 generated by Go See Talk over 15 years. I don't think we generated anything with that podcast. We generated nothing. But just hours upon hours upon hours of just doing the work. And I don't know. I think it's always worth it.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree more. And there's some things. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, Anthony. But when you talk about, let's maybe go in pecking order, talking
Sure.
about some great gets. I want to know things that really flipped your lid. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this opportunity. You talked about some of them, but then the second thing about how expectations of what the audience wants. Some of the stuff is, it's like my dad says, "What's old is new again." Like, yeah, I see so much video game music being produced on vinyl, and I say to myself, like, I never thought I'd be walking through Target and be like, holy crap, there's a vinyl section. I don't even think the guy at Target was like, we got a vinyl section, you know, stacking this. Sure, they're like the usual suspects, Nirvana and Creed and stuff like that, but like, you get some really niche stuff on these labels, like the one you're writing liner notes for, and I'm saying to myself, yeah. There is so much great music out there. Like one of the things I came onto recently from Data East is called War Wolf. And
Oh.
that is, to me, the music is about as good. Even the gameplay is about as similar as, say, Ninja Turtles. And it's like, it's driving, it's propulsive. And, you know, people who didn't grow up in the era, I mean, I just found it on an emulator about a month ago. But you look at that and you go, so wait, so people are. Who live in a digital world are sort of backtracking and going, I want this thing that I didn't grow up with, kind of like Henry Mancini or, you know, Dmitri Tiomkin. I want to put this on outdated technology, put it in a room that I have to go to. I can't take it with me. And it's an obscure title from, you know, Taito or whatever it is. So I find that revenue stream hilariously curious because, like, do these, like, what's the end goal? Like, we're gonna make $1 million and retire printing, you know, Shinobi 3. I don't know. Just
Yeah. Well, like you know, it's funny. Both of those points sort of dovetail together because I think that some of my favorite opportunities of my career have been the result of passion projects rather than breadwinning projects. But I think those passion projects end up leading to more breadwinning projects, honestly. Just it's one of the I think it's a reality of any creative life, that you definitely want to pursue the thing that you think is good because inevitably other people do. And it's, you know, it's funny you should mention the like, holy shit, there's a vinyl section in Target because it's usually when you get to that scale, that massive, massive scale where the worm starts to turn, there's like a little bit of an overreach. We can circle back to that. But I think one of my favorite opportunities I've gotten was to write the liner notes for Klonoa 2, Lunatea's Veil. And for anybody listening, it's like, what the hell is Klonoa 2?
Sounds like a
Klonoa.
proctology handbook.
So, and this is also near and dear to us, man, because Klonoa was a 2.5D platformer for PS1. and that was made by by Namco during the heyday of Ridge Racer and Ridge Racer 4. It's one of those like 1998 to 2000 releases from Namco that was just like mind-blowingly ahead of its time and forward-looking in terms of just like defying expectations of what a game can be, because it looks like this bubbly little cartoon run and jump game, and it hides one of the most just catastrophically heartbreaking stories in the world. Like
Wow.
it's an ending that it still haunts me to this day. Also, directed by the guy that created Ninja Gaiden back in the 80s. To bring it full circle with talking about like that Warwolf style, which that game rules so much.
Quirky
It's
as
so
hell, but
weird.
it rules.
So weird. So weird. You used to be able to find that game for like $5 at a Toys R Us under its American name, Werewolf, the Last Warrior, and came with a hilarious pack-in comic book. But anyway, so I get to write these liner notes for Klonoa 2. Klonoa, at the best of times, was the type of property that had a cult following. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for it now. It's the kind of things that like diehard video game fans find through emulation, through just looking back and reading about, the PlayStation era. And there was a lot of excitement around the release of the soundtracks for those first two games, because at the time, if you want to track down a copy of the original Klonoa for PS1, it goes for like $1,300 now, which is crazy. And I was thrilled to write those liner notes. But at the time that I wrote those liner notes, unbeknownst to me, the label was starting to run into a little bit of financial hardship because they had made a bunch of records. It was also during the height of the pandemic, and all of a sudden, supply chains for printing the sleeves or having the records pressed all the way in, the Czech Republic, et cetera, was causing all sorts of headaches. And, you also had this flood of, choice in across all kinds of genres and stuff in the vinyl space, like you were talking about. And, my liner notes did run. You buy a copy of the Klonoa 2 soundtrack, my liner notes in there, and I'll tell you, they're weirdly personal. Like, very, very weirdly personal. Very much about the game, very much about the soundtrack, but also like anecdotal. But they're printed without my name on them.
Oh
Like
no.
the accreditation isn't even there. And
No
it
byline,
was
that sucks.
no byline, sheerly because of the fact that there was a breaking down of comm lines between the licensor for the soundtrack, the challenges of running a label at this moment, and they were, right on the cusp of being acquired and subsequently shut down. Which, that is an inevitable result, I think, of some of the scaling up that you've seen, especially in the space. I do think it's great to see. I think the sort of like high tide of, emerging labels in the vinyl space, and especially niche labels serving, whether it's film soundtracks, TV soundtracks, or video game soundtracks. I think a lot of the labels that emerged over the past 10 years, unfortunately, a lot of them have had to shutter. And you've had to see a lot of other ones scale back significantly. I think one of the best labels in the space, who I haven't done any specific work for, I just love their work, and they were also one of the first, is a label called Data Discs. And Data Discs,
Yes, I know them. Yes.
they're so good.
I think I got Shenmue on the data disc.
And that's like one of their first ones, way back in 2015, and beautiful release. Just like something I love about Data Discs is all of their sleeve art tends to be original key art from the games themselves, like official stuff. A lot of people like they prefer like the sort of like old Mondo model of like, oh, we hired this really cool artist to make this really, really cool thing. And I'm like, oh man, get the original art. I want to see like the side of an arcade cabinet or a Dreamcast CD. But Datadiscs went from putting out 3 to 4 releases a year to, I think in the past 2 years, they've only done one new release each year. Last year they did Nights into Dreams, a classic Sega Saturn game. And the year before that, they did an awesome box set for the most recent Sonic Frontiers, which, if anybody listening loves ambient, very weird experimental piano suites, you wouldn't expect to find that in a Sonic the Hedgehog game. But Sonic Frontiers, A plus stuff. So I think that encompasses most of those 2 points. But I also do think that, we're in a sort of transitional moment where there's going to be in the physical media space, a little bit of a resetting of expectations. I can't talk about this in too much detail, but in the current job that I do with a creative agency called Moonrock, one of the things that
Wait,
I
wait.
have
Moon rock or moon shake? Because you talk about okay, I just
Moonrock.
want to clarify. Like,
Definitely not Moonshake.
it's like if you have a line to moon shake, we are going to talk about this offline. I want all
De
that good stuff.
definitely not Moonshake, unfortunately. Which I don't even know if he's doing anything anymore. He
He's
and I
like
have not.
Banksy. He just dropped some stuff and now it's like
And
legendary.
now it's all legendary. And he, we can talk, we'll get back to Moonshake. So, creative agency I work for is called Moonrock. And, it's like a creative agency, especially one that specializes in the gaming space. Name it. We'll develop TV shows. We'll develop original games. We'll run events for game publishers or just regular companies. I will say an unnamed retail chain that is prominent in the United States of America has a special interest in saying, we are a place to buy vinyl records wherever you are and vinyl equipment. And one of the things that I have been working on in 2025 is developing a brand and editorial outlet and, a whole sort of content ecosystem that would surround their new push to lure people
Cool.
into their very big stores. Some might say super stores. Audible wink. Audible wink. To sort of invite people in and to start thinking of them as a place to get vinyl. And the weird thing is, I think that you're talking about like all of the ways in which people are drawn to something so improbable, like this romanticized past technology that they don't even have any personal experience with. But I think that longing for tangibility, holding an object, going to a specific room to enjoy it, all of those things reflects a sort of evergreen desperation for a feeling of connection and physicality. We are animals. We are living things, and we will never be purely satisfied by some kind of purely digital existence. And I think a lot of people are feeling trapped by it. But belying all of that is just like the fact that like vinyl's fucking cool. It's
That's the line of the show right here.
so cool. There is something mystic about the idea that you have translated waveforms them into a physical carapace. You've captured the vibration itself into hardened plastic, and preserved it for as long as you can care for it. It will likely outlive the human who first purchased it.
And I don't know
And
how they
where.
did it back in the 1800s. That's the thing that blows my mind. Like, how did a lathe cut this thing? Which, fun fact, the grooves are not even. They are tiny little waveforms that go, and the magnet or the knee, the stylus goes, rides away. Sorry, just going.
No, but like I think I like there is a powerful coolness to that, and I think it speaks to a lot of people. I think for the case of that retailer, one of the challenges of making people believe that that's a place that you want to go for vinyl is that giant retailers are not cool. That like Target will never be cool. It doesn't matter how many limited colorways of the Beatles now and then you stock Target, you will never be cool. And so, I think that once things get to that scale, there is like a little bit of a retraction. But I think that I think that is where the allure is. I think that yeah, I do find it comforting to a degree that the most mercenary business entities that exist in our culture recognize that there is a hunger and need for that physical, tangible experience.
Well, I'd agree, and I think that to I'd agree to an nth degree. I think that's what made somebody like Mondo so successful, because there is a combination of art. Sure, it's commerce, but it's passion. But then it's also exclusivity, and the variants really speak for itself. So, you look at you mean you talk about the Beatles, you talk about, if you look at your dad or mom's collection, it's like, okay, maybe Peter Frampton, maybe Star Wars, maybe the Beatles. It's all black. Then you see there are other colors, and then you look at waxwork or iron 8-bit. It's like, wait a second, I get two options, not just for vinyl, but for like artwork. And it's just, I think that's what draws the line from cool to ultra cool. Because, you can go down a rabbit hole of, I think there was, I forget the label, but they did all the Harry Potter discs, which was something like 16 discs, box sets. And they did them in the colorway of each of the houses,
Oh,
which
that's
is like,
awesome.
that is a whole lot of product if you don't move it. I'm sure every unit moved, but it's that back and forth between what people want, what seems cool, what's alluring, and if you can give them that, or even what you were saying, how data discs had to scale back. I remember Mondo was very big on steelbooks, and that was like very heightened, and then that just kind of dropped off pretty quickly. So you have to find your lane and work with the world as who's consuming this stuff. But amazing stuff, and I don't envy you for being in the middle of it, because whether you're a contributor, whether you're a production house, whether you're the financier, there's a lot of moving pieces. So it's like just trying to move from A point A to point B and actually, make the stuff and get it shipped. That's a tremendous endeavor.
And I do think it's cool that like we are at least seeing new infrastructure for the first time in like 50 years coming to the US to accommodate this industry. Weirdly, I wish I could remember the figure off the top of my head, but Metallica of all entities poured millions of dollars into establishing a new vinyl pressing plant,
Oh, no way.
like an industrial size vinyl pressing plant here in the States. Because there are plenty of boutique operations. Jack White has Third Man Records in Detroit and Nashville, which anybody in Detroit or Nashville, go visit those plants. They're super, super cool. You get to see vinyl getting made. I'm glad that there is a little bit of that. And I do think that to an extent that fandom and passion ultimately do lead these things. Like you were talking about, yes, like you see the scaling back of a Mondo, especially after Mondo got acquired, which was like pretty heartbreaking to see. That's the story of Ship to Shore all over again, is that you have this thing, it is a passion project. That passion project does become profitable after a certain point, It becomes an acquisition for a larger entity, Funko of all. They of Funko Pops bought up Mondo, and you see, not just like a forced scaling back, but like a change in the quality of what made that thing necessary for fans in the first place. But like you were talking about, like the excitement around like colorways and that sort of thing. The large scale profit machine of the music and composition industry. One of the biggest problems at the height of COVID was in 2021, nobody could get their LPs pressed because all of the pressing plants in Germany and the Czech Republic that are responsible for still the vast majority of vinyl pressing in the Western world and all over the place, because they're very centralized, super high quality, and those facilities have never gone out of use. They've just kept running since the
Wow.
commercial advent of the format. And at the time, Warner Music stepped in and was like, "We got a new Adele album. Everybody's buying vinyl because it's the pandemic. Everybody's buying vinyl. We got a new Adele
Which
album."
sounds like corporations. They just have that
That's
East, Jersey accent.
that is the voice. Yeah, that is the every CEO in their heart of hearts. Yay, we gotta get the Adeles. That's always the voice. They freaking printed 400,000 copies of Adele's record for the first run, and nobody bought any of them. Like nobody who longed for this format was like, "Oh man, day one, I'm gonna get the Adele record." And so all of these very small labels were put in the position of all the facilities that rely on for those multiple colorways are at capacity. They're gonna have to push back all of the releases they had planned. They're gonna limit the number of variants they can make. And as part of this, the fan, the sort of like beating heart that's keeping this new industry alive, just by dint of loving a thing, is all of a sudden put in the position of like, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to pre-order this record that I have no idea when I'm going to get it? And, or if it will be any good because these pressing plants are doing their best to do things speedily and quality control becomes a concern. Looking at you, I am 8-bit. Never above throwing
Shots
a little shade.
fired.
Never above throwing a little shade. I gave them $80. I went home with my Rez soundtrack, take it out of the sleeve. There's just a crack right down LP2. I'll never forget I am 8-bit. But
Am not a customer. No.
not a customer. And then they always get me back. They're like, "But we're doing the Persona soundtracks." And I'm like, "Fine, here's your money, damn it." But yeah, it's all of which is to say, for the interest of this landscape and the difficulty of sort of making these choices, I do think we live in a very exciting moment, because people are, I think, returning to a longing for physicality in all of their pursuits and connection and art, whether it's film or games or music, draws people within to connect no matter what. Case in point.
Well, I would say that, you're pointing to the DVDs above my head. Is that what
Yeah.
you're okay? But like when you watch a movie, whether it's set in the 40s or it's set in a studio apartment in New York City, if somebody has a record collection, there's like a coolness to it in a way that's kind of like I would say smoking was. You see Humphrey Bogart light up something like, "That guy looks cool. I want that." I'm not sure smoking will come back in that verve, but hey, records did, so who knows? Well, I tell you what, Anthony, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but let's get to know a little bit more about you. You talked about your liner notes being very personal. I have a very personal experience playing Super Mario Brothers as a young kid. And by the way, I say the Super Mario Brothers because I'm from New York. I played it when I had the chicken pox. My parents, I was home one day, my parents like, "Don't get out of bed, don't do anything." And I'm like, "Hey, there's an NES downstairs." So tell me some personal experiences, the things that you like, the things that you wake up dreaming about. Oh, wish I was 8 years old again. I love this game. I still play it, you know.
Oh man. I will say, yeah, like it's funny. I like so many video game experiences that are like foundational. I feel like so like all cards on the table. I was born in 1982, which puts me right at the perfect age for that, first wave of gaming to crest and crash and then sort of start anew on the other side of, Atari and early arcades. And so born in 82, and I was lucky enough to have a father who was a just complete and abject nerd, just a nerd. And as a another New York guy, my dad loved and like I badly want people to look this up. It's very hard for people to understand in an era of like the internet and access to anything. There was a time when sourcing records, cassettes, CDs, VHS tapes, and video games was challenging. You couldn't just like order whatever you wanted. You had to be able to be in a place where a lot of those things were stocked, or, be the kind of nerd that tracked down old school mail order things. So my dad was obsessed with a department store that focused on audio and video in downtown New York City called J&L. And J&L Music World, they would just send you like a phone book sized catalog every 6 months. It's like, here is every record, every CD, every laser disc, whatever that was coming out. And my dad, just being like a tech and media fetishist, would like, if something new came along, he would go out of his way to make it happen. Like, we had a a CD player by like 1987, like, which was just
Wow.
insane. All of which is to say, when Nintendo very first started doing test market releases of the original NES and Rob and Mario and Gyromite Duck Hunt in 1985, one of the retailers they operated through was J&L. And so my dad got a boxed NES whole thing in 1985.
Jeez.
So by the time that I was 4 and could use a controller, my older brother was like teaching me to like play games. Like we had The Legend of Zelda like right there in 1986. And so like my personal vocabulary for storytelling even is sort of baked into the foundational experience of video games at that time. And the one that really sticks with me, and the one that I think like will never just stop resonating, was 1988. You have Mega Man 2, and Mega Man 2, for especially for a Go-See Talk audience, this is a game that A has like an incredible soundtrack. Unbelievable soundtrack. It is also a game that really started to toy with cinematic language in its presentation. Rather than just a start screen, you have like an interstitial that introduces the world. You have this dramatic view of like the side of like a future cityscape that rises up. And you see Mega Man himself, his hair blowing in the wind at the top. And that's your title screen. And then it blows into this just completely dynamic, vibrant, colorful action that to this day is profoundly playable. Like this is this the Mega Man 2 is the fucking Sergeant Peppers of video games. And it culminates in the day in the life of video games that you go through this like grand, profound journey. And rather than just like a congratulations, you beat the game, start it again, it closes with this somber, wordless, pure exploration of aesthetics. You beat the game and you see just this lushly animated version of the character walking forward beside a bucolic scene that all you can assume is that is home. You have battled your way across this futuristic landscape, and now you have a scene of the Earth. You have the hero's journey back. And as he walks forward, it's playing this unbelievable melancholic track, and it is shifting through the seasons. You see rain, you see snow falling, you see leaves falling, and then finally it closes on like a minor key note. The hero is gone, and their helmet is just left there. And I just sat in my basement as like a 6, 7-year-old kid playing this game over and over and over just to watch that. And sat there with a Casio boombox eventually and recorded that ending theme off the Casio boombox, and then would just like go up into my bedroom and be like, rewind, play, rewind, play. I understand that's a commercial product. Somebody made Mega Man 2 and gave a bunch of like college age artists the money to make that thing because they thought they could make more money. I think it's easy to get blinded by the reality of just like material need in 2025, you know? Like you're just constantly crushed by the reality of the world in which we live. It is very, very difficult for people to feed, clothe, house themselves, and get the things that they need as an animal. But it's always important to remember that on the other side of what seems like just like a commercial product is a beating heart that does want to give you that moment. Like somebody, it doesn't matter what you make, somebody might be encountering it with the mind of the 6-year-old playing Mega Man in a basement or the kid with chicken pox playing Super Mario Brothers. That's always there forever. And man, I hope that's not too personal. But
That is just what I wanted to hear. In fact, I'm sinking in my chair. I'm crying. Thank you, Anthony, for that. But we want to wish you a fond farewell. However, this is pressing pause on this. We are going to continue this. This was not enough. Like all consumer products, we want more. We want more. We want more. So everyone, check out Anthony's work. Anthony, this has been a tremendously fun and insightful and just a blast. So till that time, we will catch you next time.
Thank you for having me, Mark.